Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
The Lord has made. This is Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. I want to actually jump right into my conversation with Justin Gibney from the AND campaign. You can follow him on Twitter at Justin E. Gibney, because I have so much I want to talk with him about. So, Justin, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, Carmen? Glad to be here.
It's going great. First of all, happy almost Father's Day. You guys have a new baby. I think that you're probably smiling, and so I would like to hear, about him.
Yeah, he's Crew Isaiah Gibney. He was born he was born 2 weeks ago, and so we are just really excited about him. He's our third boy, and just bringing us a lot of joy and sleepless nights.
Well, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it, and a shout out to your wife, and just love to your family. The Democrats, we've got a couple of governors now who are Democrats who are signing what I would consider very pro-life, legislation. Talk with us about whether or not there's room in the Democratic Party for people who are pro-life.
Well, there certainly has to be room for people who are pro-life, because you're looking at a situation where about 30% of Democrats are pro-life. Now, the difference is a lot of Democrats don't make that their primary issue. So whereas you have an establishment that really has to decide whether they want to be a party of the people or a party of interest groups. When you go to Louisiana, places like that, Democrats are standing up for the people that they represent rather than this more kind of elite cosmopolitan set.
Okay, you're going to have to unpack that a little bit, because I think I understand what you're saying. So that okay. in Louisiana, there are folks who elected a Democrat governor. And so, there are folks, obviously, who are of a mindset that would be more aligned with what we might see. This is where I think it's challenging, because on the national level, those people may not align at all with what is going on at maybe the very top level or top line headlines related to the Democratic Party. But in Louisiana, what it means to be a Democrat is still pro-life. Is that what you're saying? Like, am I kind of sussing that out correctly?
Yeah. Louisiana is one of the only states where there are just a lot of pro-life Democrats, and not pro-life Democrats that say, yeah, I'm pro-life personally, but do something else when it comes to policy. They really stand up and say, no, we're going to enforce some pro-life policy. So in a lot of ways, I mean, Louisiana just in general is a lot different than the rest of the country in many ways. But in that way in particular, the Democrats have really stood up and said, this isn't really a Republican or Democrat issue. It's a life issue. And we're going to stand for what's right.
So I think that we're going to have an opportunity to talk about this subject matter over the course of the 2020 cycle. So let's set that one aside. And when we come back, I'm noting in my own calendar that I missed talking about something on the 31st of May. And that was the mark of an anniversary in American history that I imagine most Americans have never heard of. And it was something that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 98 years ago, so in 1921. And when we come back, Justin Gibney and I are going to talk about that event in American history and how it affects who we are right now. I'm Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. So Justin Gibney is here from the AND campaign. Justin is an African-American man, and I am not. And he is one of the people who I like to talk with, because I think he understands that I have a heart desire to not only understand the viewpoint and the experience of my African-American brothers and sisters, but I have an interest in changing the cultural conversation that we're having about this issue, because I think that it is insidious, and I think that it infects everything about our relationships in the culture in which we live. And so as a person who desires to see the culture changed, I desire to see the conversation about race and racism and racialization changed as well. And so Justin and I are going to wade into some territory that's going to very likely be uncomfortable for lots of people. And so let me just go ahead and say it's important for us to get comfortable with uncomfortable conversations if, in fact, we want to change the culture of which we are a part. Otherwise, we just sort of go along with the flow already in place. So this week, actually last week on May the 31st of 1921, marked an anniversary in American history that I'm pretty sure most Americans have never even heard of. It was an event that took place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm wondering, Justin, if you can tell us that story.
Sure. To be more specific, yes, it was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in a district of Tulsa, Oklahoma called Greenwood. Greenwood was known as the Black Wall Street during the early 20th century because there were so many African-American businesses and thriving African-Americans in that area. It stood out among other places in the country as a place where there were just a very entrepreneurial spirit and African-Americans doing really well in ways that they weren't able to do so in other places. And I believe in 1921, there was the Tulsa riot where allegedly, and many believe this was pretext, but allegedly there was a sexual assault. Many in the white community went to Greenwood. I think 26 people were black residents were murdered, and they basically just burned the place down. And so it was never rebuilt, and all the things, businesses, and the leadership there, that legacy was taken away.
So I read this piece in the Washington Post that puts these numbers: more than 300 black people were killed over the course of these Tulsa. What they're describing as Tulsa race massacre. More than 10,000 black people were left homeless. 40 blocks were burned to the ground. Survivors recounted black bodies loaded onto trains, dumped off of bridges, and tossed into mass graves. I think we're talking about something in American history that almost no one knows about. And so one of the things that we've talked about here, Justin, is, you know, the Tiananmen Square event that took place 30 years ago that we are acknowledging today. And we're looking at that and we're saying, you know, there's this culture-wide effort in China to get people to forget that that ever happened, literally to whitewash over it. And and I think that there are events in American history that are equally as horrific, and yet we don't even know these things about our own history. I'm thinking about the awakening that like literally came upon my mom when late in life she learned what we had done in terms of Japanese internment in California related to, you know, our involvement in World War II. And she was shocked and surprised. I think that many people are trying to get people to forget the Holocaust. But there is stuff in American history right here that we actively try to suppress and get people to forget or re-remember or remember differently or redefine as something other than what it really is. Tell us from an African-American perspective why it is important for people to non-defensively, dispassionately study American history, particularly when it comes to this subject matter.
Yeah, number one, because it affects what's going on today. And so it's easy to dismiss the disparities that we see. It's easy to point the finger and blame others if you really don't know the history and how the history impacts what's going on today. So, for instance, when you talk about this riot in Black Wall Street, not only does this set African Americans back and, you know, take away an example that they would have that would give them hope, but it's, you know, it sets them back economically. But it sends a broader message, which is probably even probably longer impact, which is to say that no matter how hard you try or no matter what you do, you will not get ahead. And even when you do good things, it will be destroyed. Things like that last for over generations, right? So you have this economic impact, but you also have this deep, almost spiritual impact where people are made to feel that they just can't succeed and everything they do will be destroyed or knocked back. Those things have very serious consequences. The other reason that it's important is to understand is that the number one means of exclusion or reason for exclusion when it comes to African-Americans throughout American history has been race. And so when we talk about a colorblind society and all those things, they're just not realistic because they don't take into consideration how much race played a role in people not getting what they deserved, in African-American soldiers not being able to take advantage of the GI Bill like others did. When it comes to redlining and all these things, we can't ignore those things and act like they didn't happen. And the first thing we have to do is actually know they happened and be aware of what's going on.
Okay, so when we start talking down the list of what's happening today, let me just, you know, if folks are not aware, let me alert you to some things happening today, because this is not like this is ancient history. This is not just things that happened 100 years ago. This is real. These are real people affected by genuine, it's not just systemic, it's personal racism today. In Starkville, Mississippi, at a KOA camp. If you haven't seen this yet, there is, I mean, you can Google it. It's a white woman pulling a gun on a young African-American couple. And the things that she is saying to them are the kinds of things that you would say to a dog. There is a teacher in the Bronx who thought that it was appropriate for students in that classroom to reenact a slave sale. This is 2019 in the Bronx. This is not, you know, maybe you're saying, oh, well, 2019 in Starkville, Mississippi, maybe I'm not surprised that a white woman would pull a gun on a young African-American couple who simply stopped for a picnic at a KOA camp, campsite. But I should be surprised that in the Bronx, you know, there was a mock slave sale where African-American students were bought and sold by white students. I got to tell you, if you think that we do not live in a racialized culture, you are not paying attention to reality. This is not ancient history. This is the lived experience of Black people in America today. And it's the lived experience of Black people because it's the lived experience of white people. And so if we are going to be brothers and sisters in Christ, if we are going to be people who absolutely don't just recognize that we are equally created in the image of God, equally redeemed in Jesus Christ by his one blood, and equally citizens of the kingdom of heaven, if we don't recognize that we have a shared history here in America that makes it very difficult for us as Christians to demonstrate to the culture those gospel realities, then we have to do the hard learning first. And we have to do so in a way that's non-defensive and humble and doesn't take it personally in terms of, I mean, I think African-Americans, they can take it personally. I don't think as white people we can take it personally. I think we have to say there are things here for me to learn. There are things here for me to recognize were not a part of my educational experience. And there are things I have to learn now in order that I can be a culture change agent and actually anti-racist in the culture today. Justin Gibney and I are going to continue this difficult, uncomfortable conversation when we come back. Okay, so thank you to those of you who are communicating with me on the text line. Thank you to Oscar. Thank you to Maria. That number is 877-933-2484. You can always communicate with me your comments, your thoughts, your questions. It is your way of participating right now. Again, you can text me at 877-933-2484, continuing my conversation with Justin Gibney from the AND campaign. Justin, a couple of comments here on the text line that you will acknowledge and appreciate are part of the learning experience in all of this. These are conversations that that you and I have had over the course of time, and they are conversations that have to be had. There's the comment that what I'm saying is about having white people hated and feeling guilty. All white people are not racist. That there's this change in definition of prejudice and power equaling racism. Now, you and I understand what this individual is talking about and trying to distinguish personal acts of racism versus that which really is a part of the water that we swim in here in America. It's the air we breathe. And then Maria is acknowledging, in fact, this is so astute. My guess is that Maria has an experience here. Maria is saying, you know, people say they see black and white people the same. That's that color blindness conversation. But they should not see black and white people the same. White people were never slaves. They were never murdered because of their skin color. Trauma is something that is in the DNA of black people. And so talk with us, if you will. First of all, let's just affirm that that Oscar and Maria are both engaging this conversation in the way that we would hope. This is the struggle we would hope that people are engaging in delving into this material, I used the term anti-racist. Talk with us about what it means for white people to be actively anti-racist today.
Right. That's I'm glad you brought that up. And number one, well stated in your monologue before the break. I think it shows that you really have been listening, and it shows where your heart is. And I appreciate that, Carmen. Yeah. So a lot of times people go around and say, well, I'm not racist. I'm not doing things that are racist. And that's good. I agree with the person who said that all white people aren't racist. I agree with that. I think when we talk about being anti-racist, it's saying not being racist isn't enough. Right. Because you could sit in your house all day, not say anything to anybody and say, well, I'm not racist. I haven't done anything racist. But love, as a biblical understanding of love, is active. It's substantive. And so being anti-racist is actively going out and fighting against racism. And I think that's what people are asking for. When we step into this conversation about race, one of the things I always tell people to do is not come into this conversation from a point of self-defense. Right. Trying to make sure that you're not blamed and no one can point the finger at you and your people. Christians can never go into any conversation like that because we all are fallen. We all can be blamed for something. I think we have to go into the race conversation with a view of more of a posture of self-examination, ready to say, what can I do better? Because God has sent me here to help people. If we go in trying to make sure people can't point the finger at us, we're going to be in trouble, because if you think about it, when Jesus talked to people, how many people left Jesus with a clear narrative, a clean narrative that made them feel like they were doing everything they were supposed to do? Nobody. So as we enter into these conversations, we have to be humble enough to say, maybe I am wrong. Maybe there's something I'm not doing right. Let me listen first. But I think our carnal instinct is to protect ourselves, to say, no, don't blame me. It's not my fault. That's just the wrong way to go about it. And on the other side, we have to be aspirational. We have to be patient enough to give people the opportunity, if their heart's in the right place, to understand. And also to understand that things can go too far as well, that we are all people, we all suffer. And so we don't want to go to the point where we're being identitarian and everything is based on someone's identity. But based on the history of this country, there is a difference. And so colorblindness isn't helpful.
Okay, we have a question from a listener that I think is actually really it hadn't occurred to me to ask you this, and I think it would be helpful to know. How will we know we're making progress? What is the measurement to know that we are making progress on this topic?
Well, I think one, on a personal level, is relationships. Have you built new relationships with people of, you know, from other cultures and people that that you can say, look, I care about them, that they come over. We actually have a real relationship and I'm hearing them. Am I really having those conversations? And then another, on a more practical level, is just looking at disparities. When we see disparities in education, are some of those disparities getting better? Those are some things you can look at on a personal level, and on a more practical or societal level, to tell that there's been some change.
So when we talk about disparities, Justin, education is, I think, an easy place to point, because it's measurable, and kids are actually easy to test. Like, they're in an environment where we can actually measure some of those things. I'm also, you know, I'm aware of this article that, I mean, again, it's a part of our history. This article about Chicago, like, right, that these black families in Chicago were actually, you know, cheated out of what would now be billions of dollars of inherited wealth because of the way that housing, right? This is a housing conversation. There's a conversation here about politics and power and economics. When we talk about, like, where people live, you know, is that a disparity? Is that an example that we could point to and say, you know, once we're actually living with each other, not just in relationships and not just seeing improvement in terms of the disparities in education, but when we're actually living with each other and maybe worshiping with each other, are those measurables that you would point to?
Yeah, those can certainly be measurables, you know, and again, because they go to relationship, they go to proximity. How closely are we together? And I think, I haven't read the particular article that you're referring to, but I would imagine what was happening was, if there was a certain area where there was a high population of black people, it was undervalued. And so the houses, you know, when you sold your house or whatever, it wasn't valued as highly as it would be for something that was comparable in another neighborhood. And so what that did, again, was hurt the ability of African-Americans to build generational wealth. Okay. And so that's, and we know that generational wealth can carry you a long way. We haven't had that opportunity in a lot of ways. And that makes a clear difference and goes to the disparities that we were talking about earlier.
Mm. All right. I'll send you the article. We're going to continue this conversation. I that I appreciate your patience with me. And I think that that is another part of this process, is that we have to enter it non-defensively. We have to have listening ears. We have to have a heart's desire to learn. And we have to be patient in walking with one another. And I've made a new friend. His name is Anthony here in Nashville. And one of the things that he told me recently, Justin, is that being Black in America is exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
And
it certainly can be. It can be exhausting. And so that's why we need to have patience with people, but a sense of urgency on the issues, because it can be exhausting. But, you know, everyone has sufferings, and we just have to look at one another as people and recognize the human dignity of that, which will compel us along, you know, with our biblical convictions to act for our neighbor.
OK, I love that. Patient with people, but urgent on policies. I'm going to focus on that thought here for a little while. Justin Gibney, thank you so much. You guys can find him at the AND campaign. You can follow him on Twitter at Justin E. Gibney. We'll talk with you again soon, and have a happy Father's Day.
Take care, Carmen. I appreciate it.
Bye bye. So in just a minute, Peter Kapsner is going to be here. Peter and I like to talk about headlines that, frankly, none of my other guests will wade into with me. And so we are going to talk about an NCAA athlete who is biologically male, who last year competed as a biological male, but this year is competing as a female against women and, you know, not shockingly, is winning. And what does that mean in terms of fairness? We're also going to talk about the backlash against a Roman Catholic bishop for his comments related to Pride Month. And one Nebraska school is back in the headlines for reasons that are not good. All right. All that's up next here with me and Peter Kapsner, who used to be here doing this. All right. We'll be right back.
Moms and dads have heard that sooner or later they'll have to show their teen a little tough love. But what exactly does that mean? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Tough love isn't making her suffer consequences or holding her to a strict set of standards. That approach is actually pretty easy compared to what I believe it really is. Tough love is loving your teen when she says she hates you, when she violates the very core of what you're all about, when she's intent on going against what you've taught her, and when she purposely pushes you to your limit and beyond. I know it's tough to love someone who's acting like that, but trust me when I say your long-term reward will be worth the effort. So here's the question. Ready to use some tough love?
Looking for more parenting wisdom? Go online to parentingtodaysteens.org or search for Parenting Today's Teens in your favorite app store.
Joining me now, Peter Kapsner. He and I like to call this segment 50 Shades of Truth. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Carmen. How are you?
I gotta have like a line that I say there, because, you know, somebody already says like better than I deserve, and other people are like, well, you know, I might have things to complain about, but what good would that do? And then I feel blessed. You know, I live under a cloud of grace. So, you know, I'm good. But then if I say I'm good, you know, who's really good? I don't even know how to answer the question. Could you ask me a different question? That might help.
Yeah. How about this, Carmen? What is the most meaningful thing that's happened in your relationship with God in the last week?
So I have a summer intern, and I would say that one of the things that has happened this week is just like over meals and things, having the opportunity to have a window into a 20-year-old heart and mind of a Christian totally given over. You know, he's operating most of the academic year. He's operating in an environment in LA where there are not a lot of Christians, for sure. And he's trying to do the distinctively Christian thing. Which definitely makes him weird. And so I'm exhilarated by the fact that there's a next generation that is passionate and gifted and delightful and weird, and that that the future is hopeful because faith does redound generation to generation. So the most exciting thing that has happened in terms of my relationship with God is that God is showing me that that he is doing things in other people's hearts and minds that are culture shifting. I love that.
That's a powerful testimony, Carmen, when you think about just the idea that God's kingdom will carry on. I mean, if Jesus's promise is true, and it clearly is, that his kingdom will be forever, we're going to see it manifest in the next generation. And I think what you just described helps me again sort of reframe. Sometimes I can get a little cynical about next generation, or certainly the next generation takes a lot of heat from the press and from the church, don't they? And so for you to rightly articulate, and I run into it as I teach young people throughout the year too, there are beautiful, wide-eyed young people who are really deeply committed to following Jesus in their lives. And so whatever sometimes is said in public, it doesn't always represent the fullness of the situation. So that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, so I just want to let you know that on the text line this morning, the Caps Nerds, hashtag Caps Nerds, are assembling.
I can't tell you how many friends of... Yeah, how many friends of mine would be delighted to know that Caps Nerds might be the nation name at that point? With this, you know, teasing has been my love language, and I've certainly given it out over the years. So I think there's a lot of people that would love to you know, reciprocate the favor there.
I just think it's great. You have your Caps Nerds. I have the Carmination. I don't know. The Carmination could probably take on the Caps Nerds, I feel like. I feel like my group might be a little feistier than yours.
Oh, I think I'd be in for the bronze medal at best if the Carmination came after me.
Okay, so let's jump into this this first headline, and that is about an athlete who is clearly not a woman, but competing in women's sports. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, this is an event that happened in the Track Cycling World Championships, in which Rachel McKinnon, she's an assistant professor of philosophy at a college in South Carolina, and she went ahead. It was last year that she competed as a transgendered, transitioning male to female, and of course blew away the field, as what most often happens when a biological male who is in a process of transitioning or has transitioned, it competes in a women's event like this. And Rachel, quote unquote, just obviously won the event and the gold medal, and now has come out in the last couple of weeks and is teaching against toxic masculinity. And boy, has there been a lot of backlash. That is quite a rich teaching from someone who blew away the hard work and the effort of many biological women in winning this gold medal. And you look back, and there's sort of this sense, Carmen, isn't there, that the LGBT community is sort of being roundly approved of internally, that there's not a lot of infighting or fractions and fissures there. But the third place finisher from that event, Jennifer Wagner, said back then, "For clarity, this was the women's world championships. I repeat, women's. Congratulations to the brave faces of the silver and the bronze. The world is gripped by madness," she said. And so it's really interesting that there isn't, it goes back to our conversation we just had about young people. You can get this media narrative that every person is for or against, or every person falls into a certain kind of category. But there is a lot, there's an increasing fissure in the LGBT movement and the women's rights movements and all of these things that have been fused together. They're starting to tear apart at the seams a little bit.
Well, that's exactly right. So I think to pull apart some threads and help people think through this. We have a person who is a biological male who, because he wanted to win an event, I mean, I don't want to say that that's the motivation for this person living as a woman, but the reality is, if you look at the pictures, that is a man standing there with
Absolutely.
A gold medal around his neck between two women who didn't win because they were competing against a person who's not a woman in a woman's cycling event. And so I think that when we start talking about reality, we are on solid ground. And so let me encourage our listeners to talk about reality, talk about things that are real. We have a listener. I really appreciate this. Thank you so much to the listener who just texted in. I don't want to sound stupid, but what is toxic masculinity? Peter Kapsner, can you explain to us what toxic masculinity is?
Yeah, just in a nutshell, the very idea of masculinity has brought great pain and suffering and oppression on women in particular, but also, too, it can be toxic to men. And what it means is the idea that there would be something like masculinity. At its very essence, it ends up powering over other people. It ends up sort of putting people in their place. It's a superiority kind of thing. And so there's this idea and this movement that's going on in our country right now that masculinity itself is, at least the way that it's been constructed, is toxic in our culture, and we have to drive it out. And it manifests in the fact that when you watch a lot of TV shows or stream something on Netflix or go to movies, the main sort of punching bag targets these days would be anyone who would be overly masculine, at least in a traditional sense, because that's seen as wreaking havoc on relationships and people.
Right. So I think that if we were juxtapose toxic masculinity over and against godly masculinity, what we want people to be considering is that there is a godly masculinity. There is a godly way for men created in the image of God to be men as God describes and as God desires. There is also a way for men to be in relationship that is domineering and oppressive, and that is demonstrated in many places throughout human history, and that we would point to as toxic, that we would point to as negative, and that is toxic masculinity. However, the term, I would say, has been adopted and adapted to mean a variety of things in the culture today, and so I think that it's important, just as Maria did here, to ask for it to be defined in every conversation. So we're going to return to our conversation with Peter Kapsner in just a minute. We're going to talk about Pride Month, and we're going to talk about how Christians can speak faithfully into it. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen.
God of mercy, sweet love of mine, I have surrendered to your design.
So, Peter Kapsner, the first time you asked Haley out, was it face-to-face?
Oh, brother. As the story goes, I met her at youth group and as a 15-year-old up against the bleachers. She was sitting with her beautiful braces-filled smile, and I smiled back with my braces-filled smile and kind of thought about her all throughout the evening. Let's just say I didn't worship single-mindedly that night at youth group. And afterwards, as we were walking out of youth group in a snowy Minnesota winter, I did what a 15-year-old does to profess their love for somebody. I picked her up and laughingly threw her into the snowbank. And boy, it's been, you know, nothing but roses since.
So I met Jim on eHarmony, and so he certainly didn't ask me out the first time face to face because we lived states apart at the time. So I don't know. I think technology does change things, and I'm not sure that every time the first time you ask somebody out today has to be face to face. But anyway, there you go. That's my
Love
two
it.
Bits on that last message. Okay, Pride Month. First of all, it's interesting that anybody would want to celebrate Pride, but that aside, we have a bishop, a Roman Catholic bishop in Rhode Island, who's facing backlash because he said, frankly, what is exactly accurate, and that is this. He was basically warning his congregants, his followers, that participating in LGBTQ Pride Month events would be especially harmful for children. And he said this, it promotes a culture and encourages activities that are contrary to Catholic faith and morals. First of all, did he speak truth? And second of all, what does it say that he is facing such tremendous backlash for saying what he said?
Yeah, he did speak truth, Carmen, and he took a pretty big risk in so doing. And he's a pretty public media, at least he's in the media pretty publicly regularly. So he's known to say some controversial statements from time to time. And yet this statement, there wasn't anything controversial about it when it came to relying upon standard and historic Catholic doctrine, that there's nothing controversial within the Catholic faith community that he would have said. And surprisingly, of course, shockingly, social media got wind of it, and the herd and the mob mentality began to take root. And he did take a lot of heat for that. But what I really appreciated that he did in the face of that, he said, I do understand that there would be individuals that have taken offense. And he said, however, my obligation before God is to lead the faithful entrusted to my care and to teach the faith clearly and compassionately, even on very difficult and sensitive issues. And so what I appreciate about what he's trying to do is he's not being silenced by sort of the mob community of Twitter, nor is he coming out and joining the mob community of Twitter by sniping back in that way. And then he said this, Carmen, and this is, I think, what got most of my attention. He said that he would be praying for a rebirth of mutual understanding and respect in our very diverse community. And I think as believers, Carmen, we do have to pray for a renewal. We do have to pray for truth to be restored in male-female relationships on every possible level, not just this one. But what I appreciate that he said about that is an idea of mutual understanding and respect, because with the anger that is going on among a certain segment of activists within the LGBT community, and that is, this is not everybody. There are, as you know, many, many families and many, many schools and many, many teachers and parents and people just trying to figure it out that aren't angry activists who are willing to shout down and try to silence everybody. But what I appreciate about what Tobin said is that could we not at least have conversations of mutual understanding and respect, because the understanding and respect is meant, it's only a one-way train right now. Yeah, you have to understand and respect people in the LGBTQ lifestyle, but it doesn't go the other way for people of authentic faith who are trying to compassionately talk about that. Why can't there be understanding and respect for people who would say, I don't think this is the best way of life, but are trying to compassionately figure it out and walk it out? And that prayer, I think, would be a very helpful first step towards healing and hope in this whole conversation, is we need a mutual understanding between both sides.
And a willingness to listen, right?
I mean, absolutely.
I just think that that's a part of it. So, okay. And then before we go, let's touch on this story out of Nebraska. So and I'm circling back around to this because I'm pretty sure you and I had the candy cane conversation just before Christmas, which took place in this same school district. So fifth graders at an Omaha, Nebraska school voted to put inspirational words shaped like a cross on the front cover of their yearbook. So let's just note that this was something that the fifth graders voted on to do. The cross-shaped design featured words like love, imagine, dream, and faith. But several weeks after they printed the yearbook, an issue was raised about this religious imagery. And so the students actually never got the books, is what it looks like to me. So in your view, what's going on here?
Yeah, this is a hard one to me, Carmen. I mean, I really do want to stand and support the students who, I'm sure they were not trying to make some sort of political statement. I guess I'm not sure, but it's a pretty young age to be wanting to make some sort of statement in the school along these lines. But then I've got to at least flip it over and think about the other side, that if there had been some sort of Islamic symbol that they wanted mm-hmm. to shape the words in, or even let's just say, let's go to the end of this and say, if it was a satanic symbol that they want to be, there would be backlash, and understandably so. And I think it speaks to the idea of the tension. What do we do about faith in schools? There is supposed to be a separation of church and state. So I really want to support and applaud the young people for doing what they're doing. And yet I've got this other side of it that says, but if you're going to have a fair and level playing field, you would have to allow for all forms of religious symbolism then.
Right. We would have been equally offended had the words been shaped in a way that was advocating something that's expressly anti or non-Christian. And so I do think that it is a provocative conversation. I do wonder where the adults were who should have been engaged before the books were printed. So that seems
for sure
to be a place where we want to have that conversation. All right, you and I are going to have to leave it right there. Thanks so much, and we'll talk again soon. Oh, Peter's going to be here covering the show while I'm on vacation next week. So everybody be nice to him and text him. I want to hear a lot from the Caps nerds next week. All right, we'll be right back.
We will assemble, Carmen. All six of us will assemble. It's going to be awesome.
The Caps nerds assemble. All right, thanks, man.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, we have covered a lot of terrain today. Thank you for walking with me, or allowing me to walk with you through your morning. And wherever you are headed today, in whatever direction you're headed, go with God. Like, go with God. Don't go wherever you have a mind to go. Go with God where he is going. Don't try to get a step ahead of him. Certainly don't fall behind if you can avoid it. Walk step by step with the Spirit. That is the biblical encouragement for how you and I are called to walk each and every day. Visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.